Welcome to another session. What a relief. That's how I see it. I forget until I'm in it. Daily life, even at a Zen center, is full of concerns and stuff to deal with. So I confess I can get quite caught up in the signs and appearances of Zen Center politics, bureaucracy, policies, and on and on. And Daily Zazen is a great gift that to come back again and again to the present. But Sesshin, I remember now, is its own unique gift. I think different from Daily Zazen. Same and different. To really let go of all the we might call mundane concerns of daily life in a deeper way. Settle and release the gift of Zazen, just over and over again, these opportunities to just let go and return to simplicity where nothing's lacking and nothing's extra. And I feel much gratitude for all of you who come here and make this possible. We all support each other to do this, and may we all appreciate the support of each other taking care of this container of Sesshin so we can all settle into it and drop off our worries and concerns. So this Sesshin is Denkoe, Transmission of Light Assembly. Looking at these stories of the ancestors. Who offered us their lives with great compassion. Probably not, you know, these ancient ancestors probably weren't even thinking about benefiting some people in Santa Cruz in 2013. They were just doing their work they had to do with the wish that it would be of some benefit. And miraculously, it comes down to us. Their stories get passed down and we have them here. So there's Keizan Zenji. I think y'all know, wrote the Denko Roku a couple of generations after Dogen in the 13th century, 13th and 14th, collected these awakening stories of our ancestors and commented on them in the Denko Roku. So it's our family, and you know, I look around and I see everyone in the room today has received the precepts and the blood vein document of the Buddhas and ancestors. Yeah, how wonderful! So for all of us here today, this is our family, right? This is those names that that we receive and that we chant every morning in Sesshin are these ancestors. So they're our close family members. There's a mysterious, deep connection we have with them when we receive the precepts like that. And we receive that blood vein. So just a little introductory comments about this transmission of light in the introductions. Since we have many days and many talks setting the stage, we have, I think, three translations in English of the Denko Roku, the record of the transmission of light. One's by Thomas Cleary, one's by Francis Cook, and one's by Hubert Nierman from Shasta Abbey. Mainly we've been using this Francis Cook one, but here's a little from Thomas Cleary's introduction about this record. The whole format of transmission of light, ever at pains to help readers transcend superficial externals, is a guidebook to a universal enlightenment beyond cultural conditions. It's a guidebook to enlightenment beyond cultural conditions. In India alone, there were considerable changes in social and cultural conditions over the centuries between the arising of Buddhism and its transmission to China. And it's hard to imagine any two cultures as different as those of India and China. And having traveled to both those countries myself, I would attest to that. Completely different cultures, spiritually and socially. Even China and Japan, despite close cultural ties, are very different in terms of the ordinary mentality as conditioned by their respective societies. The languages of these three countries, radically different in structure and logic, are an illustration of the enormous disparity between the characteristic thought processes of these cultures. And so he doesn't even mention America here, but, you know, in the dedication at the end of the ancestors, in the traditional dedication, the Eno recites, now we have dedicated our practice to the great teachers who have transmitted the lamp through three countries. And now we say, have transmitted the lamp through four countries. So how beautiful that we could change that dedication to add another country with, again, a very different culture from India, China, and Japan. Very different. So I think this is all to say that this transmission of light transcends the differences of these cultures and the whole way of thinking involved in these cultures. It's something more basic and fundamental to who we are. Thomas Cleary goes on, Zen insists that the fundamental human mind underlying all these circumstantially conditioned differences is one. The pervading thread of transmission of light is a grand illustration of how people can realize this unity in a manner more direct and profound than cross-cultural understanding as ordinarily conceived. Even if the form of the legends and tales in this particular text may be historically soft, puts soft in quotes, The transmission of Buddhism into such diverse Asian civilizations is the larger evidence of this simple one mind to which the quintessential Zen of this text is pointing. And at least Thomas Cleary makes this point, and some might argue it, but he says, although it uses a quasi-historical format relating to the theoretical origins of Zen and the Soto school, transmission of light makes no reference to the lineage of masters in its storyline as a symbol or proof of authority. Now, I think even the other introduction says a big part of why Keizan collected these stories is it was at a time when they were establishing the school and trying to establish proof of authority. But this is a more, maybe more idealistic and maybe true version that's not the point here. It's not about proof of authority because the lineage goes back to Buddha, for example. Never does it use the idea of connection to the ancients for the purpose of enhancing the prestige of the author's school. Rather, it uses the prestige of the ancients to evoke a sense of shame, one of the most powerful tools of Japanese psychology in the followers of the school. There is in Transmission of Light none of the sectarianism and formalism later associated with certain sects of Soto Zen to the detriment of a general appreciation of the wider range of Soto teaching. So it's an interesting point because I think you can see this as a kind of like a sectarian promotion of a school. But I appreciate his point, and you find it in Keizan, I think this point about using the prestige of the ancients to evoke a sense of shame. Keizan himself was, you know, the second great ancestor of Soto Zen. Throughout this text, can be quite self-deprecating, and says, compared to these ancients, we're very lazy today. It's an interesting mix of kind of humility and like unshakable confidence at the same time. I think it's a hard blend to manifest. The humility, it's not about an inflated sense of personal self and great confidence in Buddha nature. Maybe how this blend can work. Later he says, the whole issue of Zen transmission and succession has a checkered history. In one sense, the very idea of transmission or succession may seem to suggest that there's actually something passed on from teacher to disciple. But this is denied in both scripture and classical Zen teaching, which says that the Zen experience is not passed on from one person to another as a form, a doctrine, or hypnotic suggestion might be passed on. You are Buddha. You are Buddha. Should I say it again? Oh, yes, yes, I'm Buddha. Communication of Zen is instead defined in terms of mutual recognition of awakened minds. I think that's a nice way of talking. It's not like there's some mystical thing that's like, you know, we say mind-to-mind transmission, but I think someone recently talking about that term, even loosely mentioned a rough translation of that as telepathy. And I think that's not quite exactly it, right? It's more there's a light, and then through relationship of teacher and student, another kind of recognizes and appreciates that light. And then the first one recognizes the appreciation of the recognition. So it's not that something is being like mystically passed, right? It's more like mutually celebrated light. Light. So this is now Francis Cook, who was a student of Maizumi Roshi. I think Ellen said she knew Francis Cook.
I probably met him, but I didn't really know him, but he was
around in the early days, yeah, of LA Zen Center. He says, traditional Zen histories or genealogies are not true, in quotes, if by true we mean that the story is an account of actual historical events. However, there are other ways for something to be true besides corresponding to actual historical events. For instance, literate and thoughtful people would agree that Herman Melville's Moby Dick is a very true story, despite the fact that no Captain Ahab or ship named Pequod ever actually existed. That's true, you know? Likewise, F. Scott Fitzgerald's character Gatsby is as real as any actual person who ever lived. Fictional works such as these are treasured, read, and reread over the generations, because the stories are true, despite their lack of historical factuality. Likewise, myth is a form of truth which has no historical basis. There was never a real Garden of Eden with an Adam and Eve, but the story of original innocence and its loss is very meaningful to all who have reflected on human nature and human potential. The stern literalist who insists that the story is meaningless nonsense because it never actually happened is truly missing the whole point and needs to think seriously about the nature and function of myth. Much of the biography of the Buddha is also mythic. Hannah likes the point there. Intended to present a model of the religious life for later followers. The story does not have to be literally true to be true in terms of religious life. The Bodhisattva Guanyin is not a historical flesh and blood being, but who is more real than this mythic embodiment of compassion and clear knowing? What I am suggesting is that the Denko Roku's account of this ancestral succession may be read as expressing something very true about the survival and spread of the Buddha's teaching, about the relationship between one's own awakening and that of the Buddha, and about the essential completeness and perfection of each being. Zen people might therefore claim with some legitimacy that the ancestral succession has indeed taken place from the time of Buddha, continues to take place today, and will continue to do so in the future as each individual actualizes within him or herself that same human completeness and perfection discovered by the Buddha and pointed out to his followers and posterity. That that perfection has been preserved and passed on from one generation to the next with nothing lost and without any alteration, like water being passed from one cup to another, as one Zen teacher put it. Zen, as an institution and a way of life, stands on the conviction that this is so, and history such as the Denko Roku may be seen as ways to express this point. So, we don't know so much about all those Indian ancestors in this record. The stories are quite miraculous and fanciful. Even the early days of Zen in China, Bodhidharma is a character who's kind of hiding in the mist up in his cave. Even what exactly was going on with those first six ancestors, historically, we're not totally sure. Although, I did visit the temples of the fourth, fifth, and sixth ancestors. So there are places connected with these people. The people existed. But exactly what was going on in terms of a Zen lineage, maybe just as the story goes, but it's a little unclear. But after the sixth ancestor, things really started getting recorded, and these relationships between these particular people and the dates of their lives and all of that are all recorded. So, probably something like these stories actually happened, I would venture to say. Especially now we're up to the ancestor Dayang Qinshren in Japanese, Taiyo Kyogen Daiyosho. We've been doing these Denkoe sessions for a few years, so we left off last year at Ryozan Enkan Daiyosho, or Liangshan Yuanguan in Chinese. I'll just read the story of Liangshan's awakening, because this is he will take part in today's story. Yeah, these are Chinese ancestors after Dongshan. This is we're now about the year 1000. 1500 years after the Buddha, about 200 years before Dogen, getting close to that leap to a new country. Zen or Chan in China is now a very established tradition and practice. At this time, the Zen ancestors are already starting to quote the original Tang Dynasty Zen founders as kind of these like model stories that became like the koans. The koan collections started around this time. So there's a whole thing. Zen is like thriving in China at this time, and there's these different lineages of Soto and Rinzai. This book is the Soto lineage up through Dogen and his student Eijo. And we have, if you get totally into this and you missed the previous years, all the talks about these earlier ancestors in great detail are on the website. I think we started with the sixth ancestor, or Bodhidharma, one of those, I can't remember. But the 42nd ancestor, and 42nd means Mahakashyapa is the first, as Buddha's disciple. The 42nd was priest Yangshan. He studied with Dong'an, the latter, and served him. Dong'an asked him, "What is the business beneath the patch robe?" Yangshan had no answer. Dong'an said, "Studying the Buddha way and still not reaching this realm is the most painful thing. Now you ask me." The master asked, "What is the business beneath the patch robe?" Dong'an said, "Intimacy." And Yangshan was greatly awakened. What's the business beneath the patch robe? What's the great matter under these forms? Intimacy. So that's Liangshan, where we left off. Today we have the 43rd ancestor, great master Dayan Ning'an, or Taiyo, in this case Myo'an. They have these various different names. Taiyo, or Dayang, great son, great yang. It's that yang. Means like bright sun. Ning'an means bright peace. Must be a radiant character. Once he asked priest Liangshan, "What is the signless sight of enlightenment?" Liangshan pointed to a picture of the Bodhisattva Guanyin and said, "This was painted by scholar Wu." Dayang was about to speak when Liangshan suddenly grabbed him and said, "This is what has sign. What is it that has no sign?" With these words, Dayang comprehended. That's the case, the story at hand. As usual, these people create some strange antics. So, before getting into Keizan's commentary, just a little about this story. So, Dayan asks, "What's the formless or signless sight of enlightenment?" All these translations actually say formless, but this Chinese character really is used to translate the word nimitta. Sanskrit words nimitta and also lakshana. And really it's like sign. Nimitta is like the sign. And sign of something is the way we can recognize it. It's like the characteristics of things by which we know them. You know, there's something here, right? And we can recognize it as a book by its signs. There's signs of a book, like it's rectangular, it has letters on it, and it has these flappy paper things inside. These are all kind of like signs, recognizable signs by which we recognize it as a book. So it's like signs are the qualities of an object by which we know it, both visual objects and auditory, you know, sounds, smells, tastes, and touches, and mental ideas all have signs by which we can identify them. So to say they have these signs by which we identify them is not quite exactly right, because in fact they don't really have those things. They're actually, those signs are coming from our side. like the characteristics of a book by which we recognize it as a book, like letters and pages, those are human projections, because we know about letters and pages and colors and the various things that make up a book. So it's very convenient that things seem to have signs and that we can recognize them and talk about them and use them and read them and things like this. But on a deeper level, it's not quite how things really are. And I'm sure we've all heard this kind of thing before, right? But isn't it amazing that how we just so automatically and naturally sign things and, you know, grasp the signs of things. Actually, conception, perception or conception, the third skanda, the definition of that third skanda, samnya, is grasping the signs of objects in order to know them. So it's like one of the main five functions of our mind is that it naturally and effortlessly, the mind grasps the signs of objects in order to know them. And you know, it's so easy to not even notice that we're doing that. We're doing it basically continuously. And I often don't stop to remember that that's what's actually happening. But in Sashin, maybe we slow down enough that we can actually start to see how we're kind of like putting out our projection onto things and making them things. And if we stop doing that, we almost like can't function. So we need to do it, but we can start to also watch the process very carefully and start to loosen it up so that we don't believe it quite as strongly, that things are what we think they are. And I think all of these cases, all these stories that we look at this week, we can see them all as Zazen instruction. Zazen instruction and daily life instruction too. I think they're quite subtle, so maybe harder to apply in daily life. We get so caught up in the signs of things in order to actually work with them that it seems like we don't have time to recognize that they're actually signs that we're projecting to know things. But the more we start unraveling this in a Zen retreat like this, the more we can maybe start to recognize it in all kinds of circumstances in daily life, even just a little bit, which is quite hard, right? So that's, I think, why we have Sashin. That's one reason we could say we have this, is to like get in touch with this really, with the workings of the mind on a deeper level. So the question here is like the basic, maybe most important question for a Zen practitioner. What is the signless sight of enlightenment or sight of awakening? The Muso Dojo. So the signless way place. You maybe have heard that dojo, I think, was originally a Buddhist term, and now we have like Aikido dojo and other martial arts dojos, and it means Aikido is the way of Aiki, of peaceful chi. So it becomes a way, but originally when Buddhism came to China, they translated enlightenment as the way. So we say like Buddha's realizing the way is realizing awakening. So and there's the place at which the Buddha realized the way. Jo means like the place, so the way place. Yes, yeah, the Tao. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Same word that for Tao. And in fact, that's why the Buddhists, the early Buddhists in China, used that. They kind of like stole this, that kind of most important word from Taoism, of like the source, the great, you know, underlying, inconceivable source of everything, something like that, maybe we could say, is the Tao. Right? So when Indian Buddhism met Taoist China, they're like, many things they came up with very accurate translations of these Sanskrit words, but that's one of the interesting ones, that one of the most important terms in Buddhism is like Bodhi or enlightenment, awakening. And sometimes they translate it in other ways too, but a common one is the Tao. Maybe it was to make it kind of like culturally friendly, you know. It's kind of like this thing of the culture has changed so much, but like how can we understand this? There's something universal here that's beyond even these different religions, one might even say. So yeah, the Tao place. And it's literally the dojo is a translation of the Sanskrit Bodhi Manda. Manda is like the place. The Bodhi Manda can be seen as like the Vajra seat underneath the Bodhi tree in Bodh Gaya, India. There's this particular place called the Bodhi Manda, where Shakyamuni Buddha realized the way. So it's like a location on the earth. And there's even the legends that like all the Buddhas, you know, the next Buddha, Maitreya, will completely realize the way on that same spot. All Buddhas in every eon will always have to sit on that same spot in India. Maybe a little bit India biased, right? But sometimes I even had like the fantasy thought of like, well, in some eons from now, you know, after, it's a little tricky because actually the part of the legend too is that Buddhism, all the signs of Buddhism have to completely die out in our world system before the next Buddha comes. Because we're still like living in Shakyamuni Buddha's Dharma. So, you know, traditionally speaking, like Maitreya won't come until like everyone's completely forgotten anything to do with Buddhism. So that would mean that they forgot that the Bodhi tree and that place was a Buddha place. I hadn't thought of that before. I was picturing like someday there's all these, you know, tourists and people at Bodh Gaya, and one day like this guy comes up, excuse me, I have to do something here, and he kind of like climbs over the fence and sits on the seat, and boom, it's Maitreya Buddha. But I guess it wouldn't really look so much like that. It would probably look more like that tree is long gone, and that stone Vajra seat is long gone, and it's just like, you know, there's skyscrapers all around this area, and people have forgotten all about what happened there, and the one who's going to be Maitreya Buddha will like, you know, have to like go in the basement of some skyscraper, and like he knows the spot, right? Clear away some old boxes, and like there's the spot. Shakyamuni. I guess, well, I don't know. It's a little, like, these stories maybe get a little bit mixed, too, right? But it may be that it was that place. Or also, I think we're talking about in our world system. There's all these world systems with different Buddhas, like the Avatamsaka vast universe, where there's all these different Buddhas with their own seats. But in our kind of, like, galaxy.
So, theoretically, then Buddhists of the past, before Shakyamuni,
we're in that same space. I think so. That's my understanding. I think so. But, you know, it kind of like, even if we're talking like this, even the, you know, locations on maps and stuff like that are signs, right? So we have this like, this kind of like very limited version of time and space. And so that like, yeah, Bodh Gaya, India in this location. But I would propose that things aren't really like that. Like the location, the GPS location of Bodh Gaya is like a completely a human construct. So we might say the same place, but not like our idea of the same place. Like there's different infinite like layers of reality, we might even say. Anyway, I think he means not necessarily what is, you know, this Bodhimanda and Bodh Gaya. He's talking about the one that could be any place. Buddha's awakening place, our awakening place. Where are we? What's our place? What's the, you know, what's the site? What's the circumstance where we realize the way? So what's the signless site of awakening? I think it's a personal question. It's not a kind of historical question, right? It's, for me, this is the most important thing, actually. I know there's this, I want to find the site of awakening and freedom and infinite selfless compassion. I want to find that place, and I've heard that it has no signs. So it's a little bit tricky. That's why I haven't found it yet. And why I'm asking the teacher this most important question. What is this signless site of awakening for you and me?
Well, maybe you have found it, but you don't know it.
Yeah.
But it's signless, so maybe you have found it many, many times.
Maybe we can't leave it.
Yeah.
We're always on that site. But still the question sometimes must be asked, what is it?
Is it S-I-T-E?
Yeah, S-I-T-E. Or locate the manda, the jo, place. Dojo often means like way, place. What's the signless place of awakening? The muso dojo. Muso, by the way, we chant every morning when we say, Muso fuku dene, same muso, which I think, you know, a literal translation of that line would be signless blessing field robe, great robe of liberation, signless field of blessing robe. And we say, field far beyond form and emptiness. So there again, it's like form. Often this gets translated as form, this character. And that maybe has its virtues, but form to me implies, like the form skanda implies like physicality, like solid form. And so we say, what's this place of enlightenment, formless place of enlightenment? It has no solid form, but I think to say sign is more subtle, because it's like, well, we know it has no physical form, but does it have any way which we can know it at all? That's more like a sign. It's easy to say that the place of enlightenment has no physical form, but it's to say that it also has no signs by which we know it. It's a little bit deeper, maybe. So, muso fukudene, it's like the no sign, the signless blessings, fuku is like blessings, field, robe. So what's the signless place of awakening? Liangshan, the teacher, pointed to a picture or image, the character actually means like image, of Bodhisattva Guanyin. Maybe it was a statue. I think actually this character is used for statues too. Could have been a painting or a statue. Liangshan pointed to an image of Bodhisattva Guanyin and said, oh, this was painted by Scholar Wu. So it's a painting, I guess. Well, we could say, what's the signless place of awakening? This image of Manjushri was molded by Sally. And then made out of clay, molded out of clay, and then put into a mold, and then cast in plaster. It's a funny answer, isn't it? What's the signless place of enlightenment? Oh, this image of Guanyin was painted by Scholar Wu. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Without actually knowing the meaning as a word. Yeah. I think there is something kind of neat about these different languages where you can look at, we see it as like art. And I think in, you know, China and Japan, it's also, of course, seen as art. But it's, for us, it's in a way almost nicer because we don't immediately, unless we know the character, we don't immediately like put the meaning into it. We just see it as like energetic flow of line. So we're grasping less signs than a Japanese person might when looking at that. They just say, oh, it means da 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 da. They just get the meaning. And it's art too. Yeah. Yeah, language is interesting in that way. How hard it is to like, you know, look at letters like this and just see them as like black and white, black lines and no meaning. It's almost impossible. But that reminds me of that story that I bet a lot of people have heard about. Is it Jill Taylor who had the stroke? She has a book called Stroke of Insight. It's an amazing story. I haven't read the book, but she has a TED Talk where she describes her experience. She was already like a neuroscientist, I think, so she was new. She was into studying the brain and consciousness already. But she had this stroke where the blood flow completely stopped to the left side of her brain. The left side is like the conceptual, literary language side, and the right side is like the intuitive appreciation of beauty kind of side. We know that now that the size of the brain functions in these ways. And this with this stroke, the left side was cut off, but the right side was completely fine. So she describes her experience of at some point she knew she's having a stroke and this is like serious and she's about to die, right? But all those kind of like you might say mundane concerns were like temporarily shut off and she just experienced the world as like total beauty and like ecstatic like flow and then a little bit of the left side would kick in, like, I gotta call the 911 right away, and then that would fade out and she'd be like, why? It's all perfect. And I thought of it because I think there was, you know, she'd switching on back and forth. A little bit of the left would come in. She'd make it to the phone, and then she'd lose it again. Like, what's this thing? She'd still see it, right? But, and then the numbers on the phone, it was like something I think about, like, having to dial numbers. Like, they didn't mean anything, right? There's, like, shapes and colors and a thing, but it's like, you know, we have this whole conceptual construct of 911 are these, like, symbols that mean that connect you with someone who's going to help you. And, you know, without any effort, we can do this. But she kind of lost that ability, so she's like, couldn't quite dial the number. So why am I holding this thing? And then she'd be, quick! A little bit of, like, left brain kicks in. Quick, dial it! I'm at this address. What? Where am I? I'm at the Bodhimanda. So, yeah. So, I think it's very hard, almost impossible, to look at this word light and just see it as light instead of the word light. This one may be a little bit easier. This means light too. But before you knew that, you might have thought it's just an interesting calligraphy. But actually, I it's too late for me. I see it, oh, light. It is a really kind of like a little bit abstract, stylistic calligraphy though. What's the signless place of awakening? This was painted by Scholar Wu. And Dayan was about to speak. So I think there's something interesting there, that's part of it. Instead of just receiving, this was painted by Scholar Wu, kind of like open to the signless sight of enlightenment right at that moment. It's like, about to speak means, let's interpret this a little bit more. I have another question. Maybe a lot of questions, like, why are you talking about this painting that's just a, like, form and signs when I'm asking about the signless sight? But we don't even know what he was going to ask, because he was about to speak when Yangshan grabbed him, as they sometimes do, to become very intimate. And very direct, and like, maybe like cut off thought with physical contact, right? Grabbed him and said, this is what has sign. What is it that has no sign? And, you know, what is this? Is this the painting? Or is this? That's how I take it. It's like, forget it, we're forgetting all about the painting now. That was just to prime the pump. Now you're about to speak, and I grab you, and you who are about to speak, your body, me holding you, this whole thing, and all your thoughts about it that are quickly racing through your mind, wondering what's going on here, all this is what has sign. What is it that has no sign? And in the drama of this moment, he comprehended. We could say he came to rest at the Musō Dojo, at the signless place of awakening. Right in the midst of all that signage, here we have a painting of Guanyin, here we have like the teachers grabbing me, and like, and I'm getting a little freaked out. Right beneath all that is this signless place. So the mirror is going to come up later in here. Very conveniently in this story. But it maybe I've all heard this mirror metaphor throughout this year, that there's like, you could say the reflections in the mirror are like the signs by which we know things. They're very vivid and clear, and they appear like this and that. And then there's the mirror that actually has no signs. It's the background that's just, you could say, holding these signs. That's that makes the signs possible. That's the background brightness upon which the signs rest. And in the metaphor, those signs, those reflections on the mirror, don't actually touch the mirror. They appear to be like stuck to the surface of the mirror, but they're just reflections. There's nothing actually there. So these signs of rectangular letters, colors, and pages aren't actually on what this really is. Those things don't actually touch what this really is. What this really is can't be touched by anything. But all we have to go on is the reflections. So in Zazen, we could say it's like there's that we start to have a sense of that there is something behind all our thoughts and reflections, and we want to find it, the signless place of awakening. But it's signless. So the very effort to try to like capture the mirror and, you know, get a hold of it, of course, is impossible. So yet I think there is this possibility in Zazen of just being open to this signless mirror. We can't actually touch it, but we can have a sense of it. And in our sense of it, might be a sense of its signs, but some kind of trust that there's some vast, inconceivable source right at this very place all the time, right at the very place where the reflection meets it, right at the very place where the signs appear. So that's why when asked, what is this signless place of enlightenment? This very picture right here was painted by this particular person. It's right here. But it's not those things. But it's definitely not some kind of like, well, if some like out beyond the clouds, abstract, space somewhere else. It must be right here always, in the very particular. So it's not just like, you know, he didn't even say all of this form. He said, this particular painting, it's maybe just whatever was happened to be next to him, this particular painting of Kuan Yin was painted by this particular person. So this is Thich Nhat Hanh about this point of signs and signlessness. I appreciated his way of talking about this. it's in a section in the heart of Buddha's teaching here about the doors to liberation, the gates to liberation, the three doors or gates of liberation, which are the emptiness door, the wishlessness or aimlessness door, and the signlessness door. So all very similar, actually, but they can be talked about a little bit different ways. So there's a door of liberation from suffering called the door of signlessness, animitta. Nimitta is the sign. It's translated as so. And animitta is muso. So sign here means an appearance or the object of our perception. When we see something, a sign or image appears to us, and that's what's meant by the sign or the nimitta or lakshana, he says. If water, for example, is in a square container, its sign is squareness. If in a round container, its sign is roundness. When we open the freezer and take out some ice, the sign of that water is solid. Chemists call it H2O. The snow on the mountain and the steam rising from the kettle are also H2O. Whether H2O is round or square, liquid, gaseous, or solid depends on circumstances. Signs are instruments for our use, but they're not absolute truth, and they can mislead us. The Diamond Sutra says, wherever there's a sign, there is deception and illusion. Perceptions often tell us as much about the perceiver as the object of perception. Appearances can deceive. I think that's true. They tell us more about the perceiver than the object because actually we're creating them. And different people see things differently, as we know. Practicing the concentration on signlessness is necessary for us to free ourselves. Until we can break through the signs, we cannot touch reality. As long as we're caught by signs, round, square, solid, liquid, gas, we will suffer. That's why this most important question is, what is this signless place of awakening? Nothing can be described in terms of just one sign, but without signs, we feel anxious. Our fear and attachment come from our being caught in signs. I thought those sounded contradictory at first. Without signs, we feel anxious, but our fear and attachment come from our being caught in signs. So I think he means if we're still kind of attached to signs, then if we have a moment of without signs, we feel anxious. I think that's what he means. But like the Buddha, who's no longer grasping at the signs, doesn't feel anxious without signs. But we feel anxious without signs. That's why we like to think during Zazen. Don't we? Even when we're like, I really just would like to let go. But it's more comfortable to keep our stories going, actually, isn't it? Where we feel anxious without signs because of our being caught in signs. Until we touch the signless nature of things, we will continue to be afraid and to suffer. Before we can touch H2O, we have to let go of signs like squareness, roundness, hardness, heaviness, lightness, up and down. Water is in itself neither square nor round nor solid. But when we free ourselves from signs, we enter the heart of reality. But until we can see the ocean in the sky, we are still caught by signs. The greatest relief is when we break through the barriers of sighing and touch the world of signlessness, nirvana. Where should we look to find the world of no signs? That's the question, right? What is the signless place of awakening? Thich Nhat Hanh says. What do you think he says? He says, you might agree with that too. He says, right here in the world of signs. This painting was painted by Scholar Wu, is the answer to where is the world of signlessness. I thought that's such a beautiful commentary on this case. Where should we look to find the world of signlessness? Right here in the world of signs. If we throw away the water, there's no way for us to touch the suchness of water. We touch the water when we break through the signs of the water and see its true nature of interbeing. There are three phases: water, not water, and true water. True water is the suchness of water. Its ground of being is free from birth and death. When we touch that, we will not be afraid of anything. So to think that we might find the signless place of enlightenment some other place other than the signs is a kind of a trap. Because if we try to find some place other than signs, there's no places without signs, actually. The very concept of place is itself a sign. A sight, a location, a manda, is a sign and has signs. So experientially, in Zazen, we can get into that kind of game with ourselves where it's just, if I can just stop this stream of thought, I'll find that precious mirror. Whereas just to like release and let go, maybe the thoughts and signs of objects continue to flow through. But we're starting to appreciate the mirror that's right there with them. The mirror is not the same as the reflections, but it's not apart from the reflections. They're right there at the same place. But the reflections, we can see. The mirror, we can't. Now, if we look for the mirror, we just see the reflections. We see paintings by Scholar Wu. So that's, we're kind of entering this story maybe a little bit now. These cases usually start with the story like this, then they give the circumstances from the Chinese lamp records of this ancestor's life, and then Kazan gives his commentary. So Dayang's initiatory name was Qin Xuan, or Kyogen, as we know him, Taiyo Kyogen. In the transmission of the lamp and elsewhere, he's called Qin Yan instead of Qin Xuan, because of the taboo on the name of the then current emperor. We discussed this, I think, a little bit in the five ranks class, because one of Dongshan's verses is, if you can just avoid the taboo name of the emperor, you'll be okay. So apparently in old China, the emperors had names, and the emperor was so important, and to be honored so much that if someone came to be emperor and you happened to have his name, you had to change your name out of respect to the emperor. It's pretty radical, right? It's like if Barack Obama gets to be president and your name happens to be Barack, you have to change your name while he's in office. That's why it's nice to have Barack Obama, because it's not so many Baracks, but there's a lot of Georges, so it's a little inconvenient to have presidents with that name. So, however, his real name was Ching Xuan. He changed it to Ching Yan. He was from the Chang family in Jiangxia. He left home with Zen teacher Chu Tong. When he was 18, he became a full monk. So you could say, why bother with all these details? Well, that's where the signless sight of enlightenment is, in the fact that he had to change his name from Qing Xuan to Qing Yan. It's right there. He heard lectures on the ultimate meaning of the Sutra of Perfect Enlightenment, and no one could equal him in classes. He went traveling on a study pilgrimage. When he first visited Liangshan, he asked, what's the signless site of enlightenment? And so on, and finally comprehended. So after the story ends, after being grabbed, and teacher says, what is it has no sign, and he comprehended. Then he bowed and stood in place. Liangshan said, why don't you say something? And he answered, I'm not avoiding speaking. I just worry that if I do, it will end up in writing. Liangshan smiled and said, those words will end up on a stone tablet. That's a great, I think, these little snippets of Zen history may be true, right? And I think it's about like humility, right? It's like, I don't want to say anything that's going to get recorded here because I'm like, you know, I'm not into like fame and profit and stuff. And so it's too late. You're going to end up on a stone tablet. The teacher then, Da Yang presented a verse saying, long ago, as a beginner, I studied the way in delusion, seeking knowledge over thousands of rivers and mountains, clarifying the present, discerning the past. In the end, I could not understand. They spoke directly of no mind, but my doubt remained. My teacher showed me the mirror of Qin, which will be talked about later. It's some emperor Qin had this mirror. My teacher showed me the mirror of Qin, and it reflected what I was before my parents bore me. Having understood thoroughly now, what did I obtain? If you release a blackbird at night, it flies clothed in snow. Clothed. A beautiful image. I looked in the mirror and saw my original face before my parents were born. Having thoroughly understood this, what did I realize? If you release a blackbird at night, this is this black and white imagery, right, that we've been exploring this year too. Release a blackbird at night. You can't. The ultimate lost in the ultimate. It flies clothed in snow, in the white of appearances and reflections and signs. If you release like the host within the host, the darkness within the darkness, it flies clothed in white snow. If you look for the signless sight of enlightenment, it appears as paintings by scholar Wu. Liangshan said, Dongshan's tradition will flourish because of you. Dayang's reputation grew all at once. When Liangshan died, Dayang left the city and went to Mount Dayang, or Taiyo, and called on Zen teacher Qian. Qian resigned his position and made him the head of the community. From then on, he made Dongshan's tradition flourish and people got wind of it. This master's appearance was unusual and dignified. From the time he was a child, he ate only one meal a day. It's one of the Buddha's austerity practices. Because he put a great deal of importance on what he had inherited from his predecessors, or another translation is, because he took the bequest of the ancient worthies seriously, he never left the monastery. He never lay down to sleep, another austerity practice that the Buddha offered, and he did this until he was 81. Finally, he gave up his position, bade farewell to the community, and died. So, I'd like to celebrate the devoted practices after realizing the way they just continue in this simple life because they love it and to benefit others. So then, like, this afternoon we can hear Kazon's commentary on this story. Anything to bring up so far? Yes.
Well, we're talking about becoming a Zen dog. Maybe with an idea of enlightenment, and you bow in a certain way, and you sit in this form. So is that going into the world of forms?
We bow to our Bodhimanda. We bow to all the other Bodhimandas, and then we sit down on it, and on the front edge of our Bodhimanda cushion. And arrange our posture in a particular form. As we know, Sesshin has lots of structure and form to express and reveal the signless sight of awakening. As Thich Nhat Hanh says, where do we find this place? Right in the midst of the forms and the signs. So, with devotion to the particulars of the posture and the forms of Sesshin, that's we find it there. Not resisting or getting a hold of the forms, we could say is part of the Sesshin practice. Quite challenging, but to really like relax into, even with a painful body and a restless or sleepy mind, with all of that, to still just relax and settle into the event of the moment, zazen, chanting, or eating, work, all of it, then something about this relaxation starts to reveal the signless mirror. Seems to be like that. Whereas if we're kind of like, this can't be it. It can't be here. How can I get out of this? I made a big mistake. Then that blocks it. You know, of course it's here. We're sitting on the surface of the mirror, but we really like can't appreciate it at that time. Now maybe as the scene goes on, it doesn't depend on any particular emotion or anything, right? So it's like we could be like really like down on what's happening, really like not a happy camper about this sesshin, and still at any moment right there is like, oh, there's a signless mirror that's holding a reflection of a non-happy camper. It's such a great, and we can find those things anytime, and they come sometimes despite ourselves, often when we're not trying even. So the practice of just devotion to the present activity with the spirit of letting go and relaxation sounds very simple, but it's difficult to do. But I think it's quite simple practice, actually. Yes.
I have a question about sitting in the early morning. Traditionally, in monasteries in Japan, you get up at that 6:30 in the morning after 4 hours sleep, and it's in that most of the sitting is done in darkness. And also the tradition of Akashi, which is in the darkest time of year. And I guess I'm wondering about whether that time of day in the darkness seems, I know for me my mind is more still at that time. Whereas during the day it's still the mind.
Yeah, I think it's different for different people and at different times, but there is a different quality, I agree, with night sitting and day sitting. And the evening comes too, those last periods at night. Tend to feel like everything's settled down, and the world is also responding to the light. Like this, there are these sounds going on in the light, and at the times of dark, everybody's off work. And so, I don't know about any particular practice to do, but just differently at those times. But to appreciate the different reflections. It's one mirror, but sometimes there's a black appearance and sometimes a white appearance. And it's a very bright zendo. But this is we're celebrating the transmission of light. With Nanette's help, these shades offer several degrees of temperature shift in the seat, too. Some people might find it easier to fall asleep when it's dark. That the light actually is there's like more vividness. Or some, maybe it's the opposite. Time for an afternoon nap in the heat of the day. So, yeah, I think that's part of the joy of sesshin, is going through the phases of the day are part of the flavor. It's kind of nice. The light changes and the feeling changes through the day too. Appreciating all of it. May this merit equally extend to every being and place, that all may realize the signless sight. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.